Hey everyone, and welcome to the commentary track of The Chinatown Kid. I'll be your host. My name is Terry Brady. Some of you online may know me as Tico or Tico170. Others may know me as the author of the book Alexander Fu Sheng, Biography of the Chinatown Kid. And, you know, I'm sure there's others who may have never heard of me, and, you know, that's fine too. I'm a fan of these movies, as I hope you are, and I'm glad that you're here with me today or this evening, wherever you are in the world. Now, I'm quite pleased to tell you that this is the longer international version of the movie. Some may know it as the Southgate version. It is substantially longer than the Celestial Remaster that came out in 2004. It is the film that not only featured one of Shaw's most talented, Alexander Fu Sheng, but was also the first film to contain all five Venoms, minus Snake. So if you're listening to this commentary, I'm going to assume you've seen this film at least once, possibly multiple times, but whether you're new or an old pro to these movies, I hope to provide both an entertaining and enlightening experience for all. Now, one disclaimer here, I've been watching these movies since the 70s, and I'm not a native speaker. I'm going to do my best to pronounce these actors' names, but if I do butcher one or two, you know, apologies in advance. So what we have here is a contemporary kung fu actioneer set in San Francisco's Chinatown. Wu Sheng plays a poor illegal immigrant from mainland China whose kung fu gets him into trouble with a, you know, petty gangster in Hong Kong. He relocates to America to find work at a Chinatown restaurant where he befriends a fellow Chinese immigrant played by Sun Qian. Unfortunately, Wu Sheng can't outrun his troubles as he becomes entrapped in a vicious gang war. And now we have the opening sequence, which introduces us to Fu Sheng and actor Wong Ching-ho, who plays his grandfather. So what can be said about the incredible talent Alexander Fu Sheng, also known as Fu Sing, that has yet to be said? Well, in my book, I attempted to cover a wide berth from his filmography to his family to his marriage, but let's hit some of the highlights here. So he was born in the New Territories in 1954 and was the ninth of 11 children. Despite the often repeated tales he came from a wealthy family, his younger days were far from such. His father, Cheng Yan Lung, established himself as a prominent figure in the area and, you know, would eventually become a dominant force, but the family did have humble beginnings. Now, actor David Zhang was a family friend of the Chungs, and perhaps he was an influence in opening Alex's eyes to seek work with the studio. So he entered the newly formed Shaw Hong Kong TVB Training Center in August of 71, and immediately, director Chang Che took a shine to Alex, and he gave him his first taste of stardom in Police Force. And then later, in the film titled Friends, Alex would win the Best Newcomer Award. Let me do a quick tangent here and introduce you to our film's other co-star, the 21-year-old Sun Qian from Taiwan. He is making his film debut here as he recently departed from the Taiwanese military. As far as I know, he had no prior actor training and hadn't appeared as a stuntman or an extra anywhere. You know, Chang Che was known for trying out new talent with established stars, and it seemed to work as Sun would eventually become part of the Venoms team. His father in the movie is played by Lu Ti, aka Lo Dick. Lu worked with Chang on 20 movies, the first being Young People, he played the basketball coach. And Chinatown Kid was his last one with the director. But Lu started acting in the mid-60s and worked up until the 90s. After that, he faded from the scene. You know, he probably retired as he was in his 70s by that point. And an interesting note, he plays Sun's father here, but in two prior movies, Friends and Na Chao the Great, he played the father to Fu Sheng's character. So back to Alex, he would join Chang and some of Shaw's top talents in making multiple Shaolin-themed films in Taiwan, which truly put him on the map. Films such as Heroes 2, Five Shaolin Masters, and Shaolin Temple helped establish this, you know, contract player as a bona fide talent who had a huge rise in popularity. During his tenure in Taiwan, he began dating a Canto pop star named Jenny Sang, who was becoming one of the hottest recording artists in the region. The duo became the it couple in the Hong Kong entertainment scene, a Sonny and Cher pairing, you might say, and would tie the knot in December of 76. After 25 films with Chang Che, Fu Sheng started working with other directors. His first such collaboration was the fan favorite The Avenging Eagle by Sun Chung. Now, between being one of Shaw's most popular actors, marrying one of Hong Kong's most famous entertainers, and bonus, student of director and martial arts expert La Garlong, it seemed like the Fusheng train was unstoppable. Unfortunately, Alex experienced two serious speed bumps in his career, injuries that were to be known as Black September. The first was September of 78, he injured his neck on the deadly breaking sword, and the following September broke his leg on Heroes Shed No Tears. Despite these setbacks, he continued with multiple projects including Eight Diagram Pole Fighter and Legendary Weapons of China. Alex, you know, he had his sights set on moving behind the camera and did such on Wits of the Brats, but tragedy would strike in July of 83 when his car crashed on a winding road in Clearwater Bay. Fusheng's unexpected death was a shock to the entertainment industry, and Hong Kong had not seen a funeral of such scale since the passing of Bruce Lee a decade prior. So, throughout the movie, you'll hear Fusheng comment, "When you are poor, you must struggle." So, you know, what's that about? Where's that coming from? Well, it originates from the song in the opening title sequence. That song is called "The Devil Calls You Poor" by Albert Chung, a.k.a. Mo Hao Chung. He was a popular canto singer in the 70s who did a little bit of acting in the 80s. You can see him in the 1983 Jackie Chan Sammo flick Winners and Sinners, in which he plays, well, a singer, no surprise, at the night market. I was able to locate the lyrics and have them translated. So, but don't worry, I'm not going to sing. You know, nobody wants to hear that. Anyhow, the lyrics go as such. In the old days, poor people knew how to sing, and I heard a song that was so sad. I sang that song to my heart. I don't want you to be poor. I'll tell you to be poor. I'm a poor man. I'm a poor man. You and I are the only poor people who know how to sing that song. That song has a bitter taste in the heart. I don't want you to be poor. I don't want you to be poor. It's so hot that I have to take a shower. I can't stand the hunger, so I have to go on. In fact, the Tang people all know how to sing, and when they are singing, they use laughter to hide their sadness. The hardships involved are not known to the outside world. I don't want you to be poor. You've been so upset that you think it's a show, Chinatown boy. You've been thinking about it. Everyone in Chinatown knows how to sing. The meaning of this song is not worth thinking about. How many sorrows I can't say to the outside world. I told you to be poor. I don't want you to be poor. Now, the Eagle Eye fan will notice something unique up here on the walls behind the stall. Yeah, those are Shaw movie posters. Not sure if it was Chang Che who was the one who came up with this, you know, this idea, but, you know, it's a rather brilliant bit of marketing. Some of the posters include the events of Emperor Qinlong, Naval Commandos, and The Brave Archer Part 1. Both of these latter films featuring Fusheng. What's even more interesting is that this film, Chinatown Kid, started principal photography on January 5th, roughly 2 weeks before Brave Archer even started shooting. Of course, you know, we're not going to see a Chinatown Kid poster in Brave Archer. That'd be kind of weird because it was, you know, set many centuries ago. Anyhow, let's talk a little bit about the director here. All right, if you were one of the lucky ones to purchase his memoir when it came out roughly 20 years ago, you would have experienced a first-hand account of the man behind the camera. Now, it is a valuable and insightful look at the man who redefined Hong Kong cinema. And that is no joke. We are truly fortunate to have this publication. The idea of a memoir was proposed to Chang in July of 2001, and a first draft finished in March of 2002. Now, just a few months later, in June, Chang would die. He lived to the very end at his Shaw apartment in Movie Town. The studio was more than just an employer, but a companion for the director, going all the way back to 1962, when he joined the ranks as a head writer. Chang was an unparalleled master of the martial arts film, and perhaps one of the most prolific directors of all time. However, his work was confined predominantly to Asia and small pockets of Western fans, and, you know, and to the so-called film buffs of Hollywood, well, his name is largely unheard of. Chang, he turned the Hong Kong film industry on its head in the mid to late 60s with his violent Yang Gang style films, you know, the staunch masculinity, setting the stage for the kung fu boom of the 70s. Unlike the female dominated films of the 50s and 60s, you know, Chang put his emphasis on exploring the male physical form in his wuxia based narratives. He helped usher in this new school wuxia movement in local cinema with tales of
male brotherhood forged in blood. But what was unique about Chang's heroes was that they weren't immune to death. Their tragic yet heroic deaths underscored their mortality, which, you know, endeared these characters to the film audience. And Chang was also a natural at spotting and developing raw talent. He helped guide the careers of men like the one-armed swordsman Jimmy Wang Yu, the cunning Lo Lei, the Iron Triangle matinee idols David Jang and Ti Lung, Chen Quintai, obviously Alexander Fu Sheng, and the dazzling acrobatics known as the Venoms. Despite directing close to 100 films, 94 to be exact, however, there were a few instances where he let the others do, you know, the majority of the directing, but I digress. So, despite his vast legacy on Hong Kong action cinema, and his nickname as the Million Dollar Director, Chang was far from ever a wealthy man. Back in 2010, we visited Hong Kong, and one of my bucket list places was the burial spot of my favorite Hong Kong director. You know, unfortunately, back then, it wasn't like you could just Google it, and your smartphone would drop you, you know, on the doorstep. No, we had to do it the old school way, with our scattered notes and our pedestrian and cabbies who didn't speak English or didn't want to speak English. You know, a lot of trial and error. The first day, we actually ended up in a graveyard on the wrong side of the colony. And that was a crazy day. Nevertheless, the following morning, we did find the right location, though still unknown to me to this day. Our cabbie dropped us off at the main entrance, not the main office. So we had ourselves a nice little, you know, 2K trek uphill to the Columbarium. It did have some, you know, spectacular views of Junk Bay, though. Anyhow, we reached the office and did our, again, 30-minute lost in translation conversation with some of the local workers. And we were finally guided to this final resting place of Chang Chai. Man, it was like a holy grail quest, and a sensation of both satisfaction and sadness gripped me. But nothing like the tale I'd heard of Robert Tai when he first visited his former godfather's site. Now, he wept. Not because, why you might think, but because Chang was buried in what was considered the pauper section. Hard to fathom, a man who brought us so much exhilaration and escapism from our realities was now confined to this, you know, forgotten room in such a large structure of lost souls. I'm not sure what the local workers must have thought of these, you know, Westerners coming half a globe away to pay respects to a man seemingly forgotten. You know, but he's not. Chang will always live on. Live on through his films and his fans, and it's up to each and every one of us to never forget.
Hey, 你对饮橙汁, 入个数。
Now, as far as his film Chinatown Kid goes, one of the more repeated, for lack of a better word, criticisms you might read or hear is the movie is supposed to be set in San Francisco, so why was most of it obviously shot in Hong Kong with, you know, the steering wheel on the wrong side of cars, for instance? Well, let's go back to 1974 when Chang visited the States and Chinatown with his wife. There, this is where, you know, he started generating the idea for the movie. He heard people complaining about the public security in the Chinatown, that it wasn't safe around there. So he started, you know, wondering if this was the same with other Chinatowns. And when he found out that it was the same, he began to realize that it was a social problem, and this sparked off a desire to make a film on this. He asked his staff to start doing research on the topic, and it wasn't just the Chinatown in the United States. No, it was the Chinatowns in England, Holland, Australia. They were all the same. He believed that the earlier generation of Chinese who went abroad were very hardworking. You know, they opened up restaurants, worked in laundry services, and other forms of hard labor. Those who could speak the language were able to merge with the society. Those who could not, you know, unified themselves and survived through helping one another. Chang said that many of the modern Chinese youth in the Chinatown, you know, they're mostly from Hong Kong and Taiwan, and they belong to this new generation, and they have a very different ideology from that of the older immigrants. They didn't want to suffer, you know, the hardships like their forefathers did, and because of obstacles in communication, discrimination, etc., you know, they can't merge with this receiving society. You know, he says it goes the same for youngsters from the mainland coming to Hong Kong who can't easily find a living due to lack of education or different living habits. This applies to pretty much all immigrants in general, he said. And it's very much like what Fu Sheng's character endures in the film. So, you know, he was on a mission. He saw real injustices going on and he wanted to make a movie about it. He started planning out the movie in fall of 75, but then he had to stop to make The Naval Commandos and Shaolin Temple and started planning The Brave Archer, part one. So when he finally did commit to this movie, you know, why only shoot some quickie B-roll footage and not more on location? Well, in Chang's words, there was a lurking danger. Now, what is he talking about? Well, before he had decided to shoot in the U.S., he predicted an event, a grave event in Chinatown based upon his observations and research. He didn't know exactly the time what it would be, but then it happened. The massacre at the Golden Dragon restaurant. Now, I'll go a little deeper into that later in the commentary, but Chang nervously joked, if they found out what I was going to film, I'm afraid that the target in this massacre would have been me. And that, folks, is why we have Alex driving on the wrong side of the street in this movie. Now we have the first serious throwdown in the movie. This scene was heavily edited in the Celestial shorter version. The Shaws have created some, you know, very popular heroes for their movies, but antagonism is one of the critical tools of storytelling. Stories don't move forward without conflict, and conflict is produced by the antagonist. And Johnny Wong Lung Wei, he is the ultimate baddie. Now, Johnny has always been my preferred Shaw villain. Maybe it's the mustache, I don't know. But he's like the dastardly Whiplash of Movie Town. And beyond his ominous on-screen looks, he's a man who you probably wouldn't want to mess with in a dark alley. As a youngster in school, old Johnny often fought with his classmates, no surprise there. Because of this, he transferred from one school to another, and one month before graduating from secondary school, he got into a fight with a classmate and was dismissed by the school, so he couldn't finish his secondary education. His mom bought him an acoustic guitar, hoping under the influence of music he would, you know, become a better person. So Johnny became a member of a band for the next several years, and during this time he settled down, he got married, became a father at 20, but around 25, 26, you know, the routine started getting stale, become old, and so he decided to leave the band. And at that time, Chang's film company was on the hunt for new actors. Now, Johnny had some martial arts training. He started training karate when he was 15, so he gave it a go. And he was recruited and signed a 3-year contract in which his first movie was Shaolin Martial Arts. It's an excellent training film, by the way. So he continued making movies in Taiwan, and then when Chang decided to return to Hong Kong, he joined him. Over his career, he has appeared in nearly 100 movies, working both in and out of Shaw, and also directed several films, including This Man is Dangerous and Hong Kong Godfather. He also directed Widow Warriors in 1991.
I have a sister who was taken away from the big fish. I need to save her.
Alright, I want to briefly mention Johnny's companion here. This is Teresa Ha Ping. She's about 40 in this movie, but she got her start in Canto films of the late 50s and has appeared in over 250 movies in her career. She received a TVB Lifetime Achievement Award in 2005. Sadly, she is no longer with us. In August of 2019, her health condition worsened and she passed. She was 81 years of age. This is one of those scenes omitted from the shorter version, and man, what a scene to cut, as it features one of the first on-screen performances by Kara Hui Ying-Hung. If I was to write another biography, this actress would no doubt be in my top two. I mean, truly, the ups and downs she has undergone in her life would be equivalent to two lifetimes. So going back to the beginning, Kara was one of five children in her household, and her childhood was, you know, it was as tough as they come. She came from an extremely poor background, and from a very young age would sell souvenirs to the American sailors who were on shore leave from Nam. She did this for nearly a decade, and around 14 became a dancer at the Miramar nightclub where an older sister performed. You know, there she was tutored by a professional dancer and also received weapon instructions from none other than Donnie Yen's mother. Kara continued to dance for the next 2 years, even going abroad to Australia and Denmark to perform. And then one evening in 76, a man came to the backstage of the nightclub saying that director Chang was making The Brave Archer, and Kara, along with two others, were chosen to audition. Unfortunately, at the time, her father was suffering from cancer, so her mother refused to sign the actor's contract with Shaw because of the low pay. So instead, Kara got her older sister's sign. The first year at Shaw, she made $6,000. The next year, it was $30,000. And that's how it all started. In 5 short years, she vaulted to fame. And in 1982, she received the Best Actress Award at the inaugural Hong Kong Film Awards for her role in the action comedy My Young Auntie. Now, besides being attractive and quickly learning her craft of acting, her physical skills were easily the equal of any of the female action stars. Kara worked on numerous martial arts films, mainly with La Ga Long, but by the mid-80s, the period kung fu film was fading. And whereas other female kung fu action stars, you know, they couldn't make that transition, Kara again easily adapted to the girls with guns genre in such hits as the Inspector Wears Skirt series. But, you know, as she rose from the lower depths and basked in the spotlight, things changed around 2000 when she had a midlife crisis. She fell into depression, criticized for her acting and her looks. She even became a shut-in, stating in an interview that she was hallucinating and hearing voices conversing with her. It drove her to attempt suicide when she was 40 by swallowing over 100 sleeping pills. But like a phoenix, you know, she was reborn for a second time in her life. And starting in 2002, she was once again nominated at the 21st Hong Kong Film Awards for Best Supporting Actress. From 2010 to 2020, minus 1 year, she has either been nominated for or won an award for her acting performances 29 times to be exact in a variety of award shows. She has become one of the most famous faces in the industry once again. Another sequence not in the shortened version. Yes, and the props department couldn't find an orange box, so instead we have Alex toting around a box of New Zealand apples here. Okay, so Alex has freed the girl, you know, he's done his good deed, and now Johnny's gang needs some payback. These two thugs following Alex are two of the Venom's clan. The guy in the tank top, that's Lau Fong Sai. He has about 100 films on his resume. Plus, he did some behind-the-scenes work. He shot the action on A Better Tomorrow Part 3 with Su Hark. I remember him best as the snitch in The Five Venoms. You know, apparently snitches don't get stitches in a Shaw movie. No, they get a steel rod rammed up their nose instead. The other guy is the sports jersey. That's Yu Tai Ping. And this guy, man, he's appeared in pretty much every Venoms movie and is easily recognizable by that beak nose of his. He also did some ladder work with Chang that included The Weird Man and The Demons. Over the years, I've heard several times how Fu Sheng was not a real martial artist. I mean, sure, he's not a Chen Kuan Tai or a Chi Kuan Chun. You know, these guys have won martial arts tournaments. But hey, Alex was learning from the best, Lau Gar Lung, and that in itself is pretty impressive. At the time of this movie, Alex and his master were not together for a bit. After Chang and Lau separated during the shooting of Marco Polo, well, Alex had to make a choice. Go with Lau or stay with Chang. He opted to stay with Chang, whom he called Daddy. They had a very, you know, unique relationship, like a father and son type deal. And so Alex stayed with him, but also criticized his master, in which Lau was not pleased. Now, Lau had wanted to use Alex as his lead in his first Shaw directorial effort, The Spiritual Boxer, but now had to use Wang Yu, not Jimmy, had to use Wang Yu in his absence. And there's a few choppy edits in the sequence. I'm not really sure what that was about, but I do like how all the thugs jump into this little car and take off. You know, it reminds me of a clown car in a circus where they're all hanging out of the car. Anyway, you know, poor Alex now. He did a good deed, and as a result, he lost his glasses, lost his oranges, and now he has to run from the police. You know, the guy just can't win, can he? Let me take a moment and talk about the actor who plays Fu Sheng's grandfather. This is veteran actor Wang Ching-ho. He was born in 1919 in Guangzhou on the mainland and attended Nanjing University before moving to Hong Kong in 1947. He started his movie career in the early 50s, and you've probably seen him in a movie or two. In the 1970s, he was averaging one film a month, and in the 80s, every other month. His first Shaw outing was Warlord and the Actress, a 1964 film, by the director who would bring us the classic The Flying Guillotine a decade later. His first time around with Chang was The Assassin with Jimmy Wang Yu, and from there he pretty much appeared everywhere. I mean, Water Marching, King Boxer, The Blood Brothers, 36 Chambers of Shaolin, 10 Tigers of Kwantung, To Kill a Mastermind, Human Lanterns, you name it, over 350 film credits. He was working for Asia TV in 1999 when he was laid off. Wong Ching-ho had passed in 2013. He was 93 years of age. So the theme of this picture is obviously gangsters and gang war, and if you've done any kind of research on Hong Kong cinema, you'll know that their fictional world was not immune to real-life dangers. Since the earliest days of the American film industry, the mafia has used intimidation, threats, and violence to get a piece of the action. And Hong Kong was no different. The triads have had a hand in Hong Kong's legitimate businesses for decades, and the film industry was a very lucrative operation for them. Probably the most publicized Hong Kong triads involved in the movie business were the Hung brothers. Jimmy and Charles Hung were considered good triads, you know, whatever that meant. But their entertainment investments were indeed legit, as they ran Wynn's Entertainment, which later became China Star Entertainment. Jimmy Hung, he was more of a behind-the-scenes administrative kind of guy, while the more debonair Charles, he carved out a pretty decent movie career. During the Cantonese film boom of the 70s and 80s, the triads financed many of the Cat 3 skin flicks and action movies. When Wynn's Entertainment was at its peak, they managed the careers of some of the biggest stars in Hong Kong. Andy Lau ended up indebted to a few gangsters, and part of his massive film output in the late 80s was a result of that. Jet Li, well, he supposedly joined the organization after his manager, Jim Choi, was gunned down in front of their offices. Others included directors Wan Jing and Su Hark, Stephen Chow. Actress Amy Yip was reportedly raped for not agreeing to appear in a production of theirs. Even Jackie Chan talked of his experiences with these individuals. And megastar Chow Yun-fat, well, he was married to Candy Yu, whose family was known triads. And when their marriage went on the rocks and Chow cheated on her, Candy decided she'd let Chow live and still have a career, but he had to make one last gesture. That gesture, you know, after being beat down by her brothers, was to eat shit. Now, you can take all this with a grain of salt. How much of this is urban legend is hard to say, but the Hung brothers were big-time operators whose father was Hung Chin, founder of the Sun Yi-on in 1919. He was expelled from Hong Kong in the late 50s and fled to Taiwan, but the Sun Yi-on triad has become one of Hong Kong's largest and most powerful organized crime groups. Now, what does all this have to do with Fu Sheng, you might wonder, right? And where was the segue, Tico? Well, here we go. Hung Chin's firstborn was Hung Wai-yim, who became the reputed dragon head of the Sun Yi-on. The Hung and Chung families were joined when Wai-yim's daughter and one of Alex's siblings wed, though the two families may have had connections prior. In any event, everyone knows that Alex's sifu was Lau Gar-lung, right? But Alex began studying martial arts at age 8. Now, that's in his own words in an interview many years ago and not some silly find on the internet. He wouldn't meet up with Lau for many years, so where was he getting this training from as a youngster? Well, let's see what Chang Che had to say about this, all right? And breaking out his memoir, turn to page 95. Chang said, and I quote, "Alexander studied Southern Fist under Lau Gar-lung, but he also called Charles Hung his master. Was it Hung Fist he practiced? I don't know. Hung later became a Hong Kong cinema magnate, but few know that he practiced Kung Fu in his early days." Now, I realize Charles is no longer with us, but it would be interesting to hear his thoughts on this movie. The character played here by Yu Wing was featured in both versions of the movie, but in the Celestial release, he was supposedly a family member who was helping out Alex for no reason other than to get him away from the gangster, played by Johnny, who had beat up the grandfather. In this longer cut, there is no family relation, but instead he's the father of Kara Hui, and once Alex rescues her and brings her back home, Yu is indebted to him. In this shorter version, we only had one scene at his apartment with Kara in the background, but now we have three separate scenes. Yu would also work with Fu Sheng in the first two Brave Archer movies as the Jin Six Prince. He was also with him in The Avenging Eagle, and I believe he was in Heaven and Hell. Yes, he was the God of Mercy. Now, Heaven and Hell, that's a bizarre movie. Personally, I dig it. It was one of those obscure Shaw films on bootleg for so many years, and we finally got remastered about 15 years back. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but hey, you know, to each his own. As far as Yu Wing's career goes, it seemed fairly short. I'm not really sure what he did after the early 80s. He appeared in Chur Yun's Pursuit of Vengeance with Ti Lung, and he was in the Kanto comedy Mad Monk, the Sung Chung's The Proud Youth with Wang Yu. Now that's a good one. And he was the Emperor in The Judgments. And he also appeared in Shaolin Abbot with David Zhang. So, yeah, about, you know, 30-odd movies or so in less than a decade. But I'm not really sure what he did beyond that. Alex here doesn't seem too happy to leave his grandfather and head overseas. But meanwhile, in Taiwan, you know, we have the very pleased Sun Chen setting out on his new adventure to America. The Celestial Cut actually had an additional scene before his departure. His father takes him out to a clothing store where he was looking for different coats for his son. There's also a brief going away dinner, and the airport scene is a little bit longer. Of course, all this was done as the focus of that version seems to be more on Sun Chen's character than Fu Sheng's. And there he goes. Well, I'm sure he's not really on that plane, but it probably didn't cost the studio anything to film, and you know, Run, he likes to save money, so. And here we have the grandfather watching Alex depart Hong Kong. It's a shame Chang didn't give us a little more background on his character, you know, why he fled the mainland in the first place. It would have been kind of ironic if he was, you know, running away from some mainland gangsters. And coming up here, we're going to have some of our obligatory B-roll footage that Chang and company shot. We have got some nice images of the Golden Gate Bridge, Russian Hill, Alcatraz, and some location downtown I'm not familiar with. I've never personally been to Frisco, but I plan to be in a few years. If I have some extra time, I would like to hunt down a few of these spots that Alex appeared in and get some photos for my Facebook group. You'll see at the end of this San Fran montage, after they finish eating those dog meat sausages, an icon of the city's cinema history. When most people talk about, you know, seeing kung fu flicks back in the day, at least in the U.S., they're speaking of 42nd Street, Times Square. I was there too. I don't recall the movies I saw back then. They all tend to blend together nowadays. However, that was not the only scene for these films. On the West Coast, in the city by the bay, Great Star Theater was just as big. Opening up in 1925, it was a venue for Chinese opera singers, and I hear Bruce Lee even spent time as a kid there watching his dad perform. Great Star showed many Shaw flicks back in the 70s and the 80s, and if Chang had more time to shoot, I would have loved the scene where Alex stops by the theater. You know, with Alex being the prankster, the jokester he was, I would have had him, you know, scrutinize the movie poster, maybe even a Jackie Chan movie in which he makes a passing comment like, huh, he looks pretty good, but I bet I could beat him, and then, you know, continues walking on down the street. Just a little tongue-in-cheek humor for us fans. Alas, a missed opportunity for us. And here we have Sun Chen in America. Actually, it's the backlot of Shaw, but don't tell anybody. And if you've ever worked in a restaurant, you'll know it's not easy. I waited tables for 3 years in college, and while I have some good memories, you know, we put in the work. And the owner of this establishment is actor Yang Chi-ching. Now, this guy goes way back. He started his career in film in 1941, and in his early years, acted in dramas on the mainland. He would settle in Hong Kong in 1951 and join the Shaw Brothers, where he worked for 3 decades and appeared in more than 100 movies. He was married to actress Chen Wan-Hua, who appeared in The Mermaid and Inside the Forbidden City, both 1965 films and both scripts by Chang Che. This actress we see here is Shirley Yu, who plays his daughter. I'm going to talk more about her in a little bit. As far as Yang, in a career spanning 300 productions, he worked to the very end, passing in 1984. After his death, 3 of his movies had yet to be released, which included the classics Opium and the Kung Fu Master and Disciples of the 36th Chamber, in which he played Chief Yang. Now, this exchange here between Fu Sheng and Yu Wing always cracks me up. The scene was cut short in the Celestial version. You know, Shirley walks out, Alex looks, and then heads in to meet the boss. So we miss out on this little bit of dialogue. Of course, it's a translation issue, but the back and forth between the two reminded me of an Abbott and Costello skit in which Alex, you know, no matter how much he tries to explain, still isn't getting it. It's a subtle but nonetheless a funny situation. The exclusion of this bit in the Celestial version takes away from Fu Sheng's natural comedic abilities, which were apparent in several aspects of this movie. Sun Chen, he has to be undoubtedly the king of internet rumors, at least as he is the least known of the Venoms, you know, publicly speaking, that is. Over the years, I've heard various things. For instance, after retiring from the industry, he was a manager at a McDonald's. That he drove a double-decker bus. That he was Korean. That he lost an eye in a fishing accident. Okay, that last one, I believe is true because it came from a reputable source. But the others, well, I definitely know he's not from Korea. Yeah, sure, he studied Taekwondo, but that doesn't mean it makes anyone Korean, you know? The bus driver and burger job, well, there's nothing wrong with honest work, and I'm not knocking it either. He could be a scientist, a street cleaner, honestly, I don't care. What I do care about is doing my best to verify facts and not repeating incorrect information. And, you know, that's how it goes with a tale or a story. It continues to be repeated until it's perceived truth. For years, we've heard the rumors that this international print was destroyed in the Great Shaw Fire. Sorry, incorrect. One of my favorites? Fu Sheng bought Bruce Lee's house and was living there when he died. Again, incorrect. Anyway, Sun Chen, if you're listening to this commentary, you know, give me a call and we get all this business straightened out for you. Nah, I don't think he's listening, but it would be cool to chat up the guy, you know? So, what do we know? Well, we know Sun Chen was born in Taiwan, and at some point during his childhood, his parents died. I'm uncertain if these were separate deaths or they passed together. After that, his two older sisters were left in charge of him, and following high school, he was unable to attend college, so he joined the army instead. After his 2-year stint, he saw an advertisement that Chang was recruiting actors. You know, it seems like a lot of these stars we know had this in common. T. Long, Johnny Wang, Kwok Choi. I mean, I can compile a pretty long list. Anyway, one of his sisters persuaded him to give it a try, and since he didn't have any job prospects, you know, he sent in his application, and as luck would have it, he was chosen among all the other candidates. And Chang was very enthusiastic about his new find. Apparently, one day Chang had a meeting with Run Run Shaw, who was praising the leg technique of some actor. And Chang commented he had found someone who had a similar technique. Shaw wasn't familiar with Sun, but he said that since he has such a high level of technique, why don't we promote him? So soon thereafter, Sun signed an 8-year contract with the studio. I know, that seems a bit excessive. In order to announce the news to the entertainment sector of Hong Kong, Chang brought photos of him to the reporters and said, "Hey, see, this is my new weapon." Now, two things Chang changed about his new protege. He deleted a word of his original name, Qian Yun Sun, and left the two words Qian Sun as his stage name. He also made him don old-fashioned black, thick-rimmed glasses for his maiden role in Chinatown Kid, even though he doesn't wear glasses. Following that film, Sun was made famous to the world as number 3, the Scorpion, in 5 Venoms. He continued to make other films, and one of his last pictures before they shut the studio down was Pursuit of a Killer. He stayed busy through the rest of the 80s, appearing in low-budget ninja films. After The Plot and Angry Ranger, both 1991, he kind of pulled a Kaiser Soze, and, you know, like that, he was gone. Well, not really gone. About 15 years back, a photo of him surfaced, along with Venom Clan members Yu Tai Ping, Robert Tai, plus Li Ai Min, and younger brother Li Lung Yin. And Sun was looking in good health, and not in a McDonald's uniform either. While these accommodations might seem a bit extreme, I'm sure it reminded Sun of his flat in dormitory number 2 back at Movie Town. There on the second floor, amongst numerous densely packed rooms, Sun called his 100-square-foot dorm room home with its very meager furnishings, in which he shared it with his 2 birds and a German Shepherd. And I would go downstairs and visit the bosses. Oh, they got to bang their head first on that thing. All right, so we have our 2 cooks. Okay, the older gent is Wang Hung Chun. Now, he started in the late 60s and appeared in over 200 movies, both at Shaw and elsewhere. He was never a leading man per se, but was always very active in the scene and played a variety of roles. He was a sheriff in Delightful Forest, 1972, the headmaster in Hong Kong, 73, a prison officer in The Condemned, 1976. Now, that is a solid film starring David Zhang, by the way. You need to check it out. Wang was also featured numerous times as a manager, an inn, or shopkeeper, and even in Abbott a few times. His last known appearance was in Golden Harvest's Operation Scorpio in 1992. And the younger cook we saw is Ku Kwon Chung. Starting his career in the mid-70s, he was in the fourth class of the joint Hong Kong TVB training program. I first noticed him as Eastern Devil in The Brave Archer Part 1. He worked with the Shaw Brothers until the very end and did various Hong Kong films in the 90s. He also worked over in Taiwan for nearly 20 years and has acted in roughly 50 Taiwanese dramas, mostly costume dramas. In 1988, he was nominated at the 23rd Golden Bell Award for Best Actor, and in 2009, he was voted number one in the CTV 40th Anniversary Classic Drama Poll. He took a leave from acting for a while and returned to Hong Kong to look after his ailing father. I'm going to send Soon topside. You'll fetch some mushrooms and stuff. So, Alex here is going to show us his little thing, his squeezing the juice thing. Not really sure why he needs those knives, though. I mean, you get the kung fu, chop. But anyhow, you're going to squeeze him up, and he's going to do his little, when you're poor, you must struggle, and they got to have that, quack, 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 that crazy music. Let's take our first visit to the Green Tigers headquarters, one of the two competing gangs in Chinatown. This here is the head Green Tiger. Now, I know you know who this guy is, right? When we talk the real deal, this guy was the real deal. Meet the Toad, a.k.a. Lo Mong, my favorite Venom. He started his kung fu instruction as an early teen. His older brother was actually Chang Shei's chauffeur, but his brother forbid him to get involved in the film industry. While Lo was working at Chang's company as a security guard, he decided not to take that advice and applied anyway. He got his first gig as an extra in Shaolin Temple, but gained popularity after his appearance in The Five Venoms, as well as The Kid with the Golden Arm. He would make almost two dozen movies with Chang, and while the other Venoms returned to Taiwan, he stayed at Shaw until its closure. He later went to TV, but continues to act in features, recently appearing in Ip Man 3 and Ip Man 4. Now this other guy here, well, that's Dick Wei, another real deal. Born in southern Taiwan as Tu Jinlong, he was a captain in the Taiwanese army, where he taught Taekwondo and other fighting techniques. He actually started his martial training at an early age, learning karate and doji kwan, and won many combat tournaments in junior high. In 75, he signed a contract with the Shaws, and he moved to Hong Kong. Originally, his stage name was Tu Long, and credited as such. But I remember reading a funny tale once that he felt his name, the stage name, was too similar to another Shaw star, and he demanded that the other actor change his name. I'm not sure if that's true, like I said, which is a kind of funny tale. Anyhow, he appeared in about 20 Shaws, from Invincible Shaolin to The Convict Killer, before he moved to Golden Harvest, where he joined Sammo Hung's team. He played a string of memorable villains in the 80s and 90s, and was in such gems as Project A, Eastern Condors, and Pedicab Driver. Here's our guy, Johnny Wong, visiting from Hong Kong. Since we're talking Venoms here, this chap is the student Zhang Sheng. Now, there's been some debate over the years that he isn't an actual Venom. And if you want to get technical, then yes, he wasn't. He wasn't one of the original five, but instead a student that Dick Wei's character teaches after the fact. But let's not mince words here. Sheng is indeed a part of the Venoms, especially since Wai Pei decided to take a powder after only a few times with the team. So a little background on Sheng. He originally hailed from Taiwan, and he learned his craft at the Honam Opera School with fellow Venoms Yu Taiping. He would later move to the Fuxing Opera School, where he met good friend Robert Tai. Sheng's mother died at a young age, and his father had to work away from home, and so all the kids got split up. Sheng finally lived with Robert Tai for many years until the pair joined up with Chang and later moved to Hong Kong. Now, besides working as an actor, Sheng became director Chang's assistant and helped him behind the scenes on nearly two dozen Venom movies. Later, he went back to Taiwan and stayed busy in film and TV until his untimely death in 1991. By the way, there's a new Facebook group devoted to the actor. It's called Inside Zhang Sheng and has some really unique info, so check it out.
老板同呢度大金有联络嘅咩？
Being a big fan of Pink Floyd, I've always dug this kind of Pink Floyd-esque 70s theme that they got going on here. It's called a leitmotif. It's a recurring piece of music or melody that represents a character, action, or theme. You remember the music in Jaws? Perfect example. If you're a fan of the spaghetti westerns like I am, then I bet you recall that harmonica tune, which coincided with Charles Bronson's character in Once Upon a Time in the West. So yeah, this little Pink Floyd harmony is for our character, Mr. Wan, played by Choi Wong, a Taiwanese-born actor who played a lot of heavies in the 70s. One of his earliest roles was the Shadow Girl in 1971 with Lily Lee. This was one of those movies that didn't get a remaster release, nor was it on the Zai Eagle box that came out many years ago. Only a poor bootleg made the rounds, until recently, that is. A remastered print with fan subtitles has emerged online, so if you can locate it, definitely check it out. Anyhow, as far as Wong, he played in nearly 100 films during the 70s, both at Shaw and elsewhere. You can see him in Bloody Treasury Fight, One Foot Crane, The Shaolin Avengers, and the classic One-Armed Boxer. He would continue to act in the 80s and 90s, though his output became less as the years wore on. He does have a Facebook profile and has interacted with fans, though the exchange is pretty much minimal. Now, his right-hand man here is Venom actor Wong Lee, who has been named by his fans as the honorary sixth Venom. Born in Hong Kong, he auditioned for Chang's film company while living in Taiwan with his dad. He signed as a contract player and performed in Seven Man Army, but also appeared the same year in One-Armed Boxer vs. the Flying Guillotine. After Chang returned to Hong Kong, Wong joined the Shaw Brothers and performed in all of the Venom movies. Now, he's normally cast as a baddie, but his on-screen abilities always shined. Some of his better performances included Magnificent Ruffians and Killer Army, but The Daredevils is where Wong really stole the show for me, especially in the finale, where he takes on three of the Venoms. I mean, that's gold. So, Wong stayed at Shaw till the end. And then, as far as I could tell, worked briefly for another 5 or 6 years. He was a policeman in Sun Chung's City War, 1988, starring Ti Lung and Chow Yun-Fat, which is another one of those buddy cop movies a la Lethal Weapon. From what I've read, it's not as intense as A Better Tomorrow, but I would like to see it one day, as you have various Shaw alum in this one, including Mr. Five Fingers of Death himself, Lo Lei. Some of you listening to this track, who may have not seen the shorter version of this movie, might be wondering what this Celestial remaster was all about. And why did Chang Che shoot two different versions of the movie? And hey, Tico, wasn't the longer version burned in the Great Shaw Fire? Okay, first let's address that last one. There was no fire. Repeat, no fire. Nothing but an urban legend, which may have stemmed from one of two actual fires. In 91, there was a warehouse fire at TVB, which destroyed their prop department, and the other was 1996, the Garley Building Fire in Kowloon, which took 41 lives, including film producer and owner of Filmark International, Thomas Tang. So, now let's talk about alternate versions. Yeah, we've seen lots of small edits over the years. One of the bigger ones is that minute of footage omitted from The Avenging Eagle, but never before have we witnessed such drastic changes as we had back in 04, when the Celestial remaster of Chinatown Kid was released. So, you know, what was that all about? Well, the Shaws prided themselves on keeping, you know, everything under their control. They had their own dubbing and editing teams on site, you know, to create alternate versions for markets with different standards. They cut and dubbed the film as the export country required, and then local censors would cut them again. So it was common practice to shoot additional footage for certain markets to fill out the running time. The ending of Chinatown Kid with Fu Sheng dying is the original ending intended for international markets, except, you know, maybe Southeast Asia. The alternate ending with Fu Sheng getting arrested was for countries like Malaysia and Singapore, you know, where censorship was much stronger. And that's why the emphasis is on the Sun Chen character more so in that shorter version. He appears first in the film, then Fu Sheng. It's actually flipped in the international version. In the Celestial release, at the end, we have the focus on Soon as he moves on with his life with the final images of the school children. This was meant to further ingrain in the mind of the viewer that an education must begin at an early age, and that'll pay off in the end, or, you know, simply crime doesn't pay. However, it still doesn't answer the question, why did we get this shorter version of the movie? One person who knows the answer is former Celestial CEO William Pfeiffer, but he did not respond to my question in time for the commentary, so we're just going to have to continue to make up our own tales. But hey, no fire stories, please. Ah, the streets of San Francisco. You know, where's Carl Malden and Michael Douglas when you need them, huh? Now, that American TV show was actually filmed entirely on location in the Bay Area, giving an additional authenticity to the series, while the city itself definitely was kind of a co-star to the actors. The second half of the final season was actually released at the time Chang was making Chinatown Kid. You know, it's a shame that the director didn't use more location shoots instead of these backlot shoots somewhere in Movie Town. During this time, I could think of two Hong Kong movies that were truly shot in the Bay Area. One was Lo Wei's Yellow-Faced Tiger, which from what I've read was originally planned to be Bruce Lee's third project following Fist of Fury. However, the creative duo went their separate ways, and Yellow-Faced Tiger was shelved for a couple years before being released as Slaughter in San Francisco, starring Don Wong and Chuck Norris. Another film, also by Lo, was Chinatown Capers, which was a big box office hit in Hong Kong when it was released. You know, maybe Chang should have hired Lo to do some additional second location shooting for our Chinatown Kid film here. In his memoir, Chang alludes to a possible third ending for the film, a scene in which Fu Sheng's character falls into the sea and dies during a police raid. No mention if this was just part of his original script or an actual scene that was lensed, but never made it to the final edit. Now, these two guys on the ground that Lo Mang just beat the spit out of, well, the first was Tony Tam Chun Do. You've probably seen him in multiple Chang Che Venom films from Shaolin Temple all the way to Ode to Gallantry. And the second guy, the one that came out of the club, well, that's our number one. That's the centipede, Lu Fong. He was actually in the U.S. a few years ago for a convention in New York City, and he got to meet some of the fans. I didn't get to attend that one, and you know, I'm still kicking myself for that. And Alex briefly enjoying some of the sights of the city, but it doesn't last very long as we're back here in the studio. But now in this scene, we're going to be introduced to a very significant actress. Not so much as this film goes, but for Alex, probably the most important person in his life. This is Jenny Tseng, actress, singer, entertainer extraordinaire, and of course, new wife to our star, who is lugging dirty laundry. The funny thing is, according to Jenny, Alex wasn't much about household chores. She said that when she would go overseas on trips or concerts, Alex was supposed to handle the household bills and the tax returns and clean up the place, but she would come back and the bills were never paid. She had to pay fines and, you know, dust and socks and clothes were everywhere, and she was just mortified. So, yeah, even though they were big stars, they too had everyman problems. In other people's eyes, you know, movie stars, they were wealthy and above such petty difficulties. They got the designer clothes, and they drive the fancy cars, live in mansions, hobnob with the other rich and famous, you know, blah, blah, blah. However, most people never saw how hard it was for them when they first started. Jenny said in an interview, and I'll quote, "When we first started dating, Alex was only a movie actor, and his salary was just $6.50 a month. Though I earned much more, we didn't go to clubs or restaurants. We ate at the food stalls on the street and went to the countryside on the weekends. These are my happiest memories," end quote. So, while Alex may not have been, you know, Susie Homemaker, he was a knight in shining armor. And here he goes about defending Jenny's honor against two green dragon thugs. We have Lee Ka-Ting and Robert Tai. The Celestial cut, well, there were some bad edits in that one, but here we finally had the full fight. As far as Lee, well, he had a riches-to-rags beginning, actually. He was born into a wealthy family. His father was a major landowner in Guangzhou, and supposedly he lived in a 200,000 square foot mansion. Unfortunately for them, the Chinese land reform movement wiped them out, and they had to flee to Hong Kong, where they lived a very meager existence. Lee learned martial arts at age 15, started working as a martial arts teacher at 20. He officially joined the industry in 65, and several studios wanted to hire him as a leading actor, but he declined the low-paying acting roles for his family. So he continued to work instead as a martial artist until 1982, and because of his, you know, stern and angry appearance, was often cast as villains or martial arts masters. Nowadays in the industry, he's known as Grandpa Ding, and I'll explain that in a second. Lee's film appearances were near 100, but he was also a martial arts director on 18 movies, including this one, and was the action director for 1988's Bloodsport. He began to work for TVB in the early 80s, but in more recent years, he has been the host of a cooking show called Grandpa's Kitchen. The series has provided him many accolades, and in 2017, he released his first personal cookbook during the Hong Kong Book Affair, which became the best-selling book of the publisher. The other thug fighting here is, of course, the ever-versatile Robert Tai, actor, director, writer, martial arts coordinator. You know, Tai wore many hats over his career, and some have said that he could have been one of the greats, but according to good friend Toby Russell, the problem with Tai is he had a very powerful personality. Lo Wei fired him, Sun Chung fired him, even Chang Che had difficulties with him as he shut down Venom sets on more than a few occasions. He even flew home to Taiwan at a protest during the filming of Life Gamble. You know, despite all this, he did deliver us some amazing choreography on so many films, and that's what we really should bear in mind. You might say he was a creative genius, and it was best to just leave him alone and let him do his own thing. Sadly, Robert passed in 2017 after a valiant fight, but in those last years of his life, he interacted with many of his fans here on Facebook. And, you know, while I'm digging the background music here, Choi Wong delivers the ultimate line. I wouldn't know. This is Chinatown. And he just walks off, man. It's perfect. Hello, Ma. Looking like a boss here. He's collecting his hard-earned pay. Well, not exactly his hard-earned pay. Anyway, I got to meet and interview my favorite Venom back in 2007. He had come to Philadelphia for an event, and I joined the festivities that August with some fellow fans like Brian, Jesse, Ian, and the late Lynn Haynes. It was a very steamy weekend in the city, and we were in Chinatown, and the first day, many fans were just hanging out outside in the heat, you know, waiting for the initial ceremony to start. But inside a small cafe, a bakery shop, there was like a handful of seated participants, and the event coordinator summoned me in and introduced me to the gentleman seated at the first table. Yeah, it was Lo Mang. And we shook hands, and then Lo invited me to sit down next to him. And I was thinking, seriously? Me? Sit next to you? Well, okay. You know, I mean, for 30 years, this guy was just a two-dimensional figure on the big and small screen. But now, here he was in the flesh. I mean, yeah, I was a little starstruck, okay? So, all right, so there's maybe six or seven of us in the shop. You know, Lo seemed very enthusiastic about his maiden trip to the U.S. as he conversed with the assistance of a pair of translators. He boasted about finally getting to jog up the museum steps made famous by Rocky. And then the discussion moved on to his first movie, which was Chang Shaolin Temple. And I started to rifle through this small bag I brought with me. I pulled out a glossy photo of him from the film and handed it over. And man, you should have seen the look on his face. It just lit up with like this big smile as he started to relive his youth working on his first ever Shaw Brothers production. You know, the funny thing about Shaolin Temple, the day he first met Chang, he was extremely nervous, he told me. Chang was a well-known director, and Lo's stomach was in a tight. He had to rush off to the bathroom, you know, because he was just overwhelmed. He came out, but then, you know, to meet Chang, but then he needed to go right back to the toilet, and Chang said to him, wait, sit here, right here. I mean, literally, this is Lo Mang in English imitating the director now. You sit right here, you sit. I mean, Lo was very animated, and I was about to bust the gut, man. I mean, sit, you sit. So anyway, the next day was the main event, and I got to finally do my interview with him. He did speak some English, but there was also a translator present, which helped. Again, I brought my bag full of notes and photos and revisited his past career with him. I had a list of all his films and the people he worked with, etc. And at one point, he stopped me and was like, how do you know all this? I mean, I guess to him, it was just a job. And his memories were sometimes blurred between the various movies he made. And he was kind of pleasantly dumbfounded that some random Western fan knew so much about his career. So after a 45-minute chat, I dipped once again to my bag of tricks, right? I pull out a photo of him, the Chang Che, and the set of Invincible Shaolin. I handed it to him, hoping, you know, get an autograph, and he immediately eyeballed the photo and proceeded to fold it and stuff in the back, in his back pocket. And then he said, big silly grin on his face. He was just so happy to have the photo. I was like, well, no, actually, I need, so I finally just gave up the ghost and let him keep it. You know, he seemed pretty content about having it, and I was not about to challenge the guy, you know, in Mortal Kombat to get it back. So, no autograph for me. But, hey, I got to spend 2 great days with the guy, so I can't complain either, you know. As far as my interview, it was raw and needed some heavy-duty editing and B-roll. The plan was to include it as an extra on one of those U.S. labels back then, maybe BCI, but then they folded their tents and it got shelved. I have been told by a close source that Lomong and Alex were friends outside the studio, at least later in life. They both hail from the New Territories, and on that fateful day, Alex had breakfast, or was supposed to have breakfast, at Lo's house. Back when I interviewed Lo, I didn't go into Fusheng at all, as my focus then was on the Venoms. But had I known I was going to do a book on Alex, I would have certainly picked his brain more. I know many like to speculate on what Alex would have done if he had lived, and they also like to compare him to another highly successful star of the time. You know, whether or not Fusheng would have followed in the shoes of this actor, or whether Fusheng would have stolen the limelight from this actor. Lots of guesses, but there's no way of knowing. And of course, the actor I speak of is Jackie Chan. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It's a comparison of apples and oranges. Yes, they were both extremely talented and successful players in their own right. Had Alex lived, would he have given Jackie a run for his money? I'm thinking fans have this idea that it would have been like the Mark McGuire-Sammy Sosa home run chase from 1998. But that wouldn't be the case. You know, Jackie possessed a different skill set than Alex with his Peking opera background. And beyond that, Jackie had creative freedom that Alex didn't get to truly benefit from. You know, end of the day, he was still just a Shaw employee. Let's do a quick history lesson here. Flashback to the 60s, where the Shaws were dominating the scene. All right. Their main competitor was MPG&I, who had studios in Hong Kong but headquarters in Singapore. Unlike Run Run, who was on the set every day and could make changes on the fly, the brass at MPG&I couldn't react fast enough. You know, obviously no internet, no faxes back then. So Shaw had this upper hand, and his rivals just couldn't keep up. Then the 70s arrived, and along with it comes the Cantonese revival and the surge in television ownership. You know, Shaw was all about making movies in the Mandarin language because he was working the international market. Cantonese was just a local dialect, and Cantonese films had come to a standstill, but not for long. So now you've got Raymond Chow scooping up the old studios of MPG&I, and like Run Run, you have the top man for Golden Harvest on the ground locally, making Cantonese pictures. And he's proposing an independent production system, you know, satellite companies within the studio, where the stars and directors would approve mutually profitable deals. This is unheard of at Movie Town. So, how does Jackie and Alex fit into all this? Well, Jackie wasn't under the iron grip of Shaw. Basher flicks, Shaolin movies, they were becoming repetitive, and the locals were longing for something new. In the late 70s, there were a time of recession, double-digit inflation and crime. The arrival of the Cantonese comedies were just the ticket for escapism, and, you know, Jackie ran with it. Had Alex had the freedom Jackie did, I'm sure he would have done the same, at least tried the same. Unfortunately, even if he had, Alex sustained those major injuries, you know, the Black September injuries, which was slowing him down. He wouldn't have been able to keep up with Jackie's physical attributes. You know, perhaps going behind the camera, he could have continued to extend his career to a certain point. A good friend of his told me that Warner Brothers had reached out to him. No idea what their intentions were. Again, it's anyone's guess. One of his brothers posted on Facebook several years back, "Good people tend to die young. I don't think he would enjoy growing old and gray like me. He helped me to see life and death as just a process of life in which none can escape. It's more important to live a life that's full of adventure than bail out at an old age in a nursing home." You know, the bottom line, Alex and Jackie were two different entertainers. They both brought many gifts to the table. And it's probably best just to remember and enjoy what Fusheng provided us and not really worry about what he could have done. Oh, the gambler here with the glasses? Now that's co-writer James Wong Jim. Yeah, besides doing a lot of bit roles, he wrote lyrics for many films, including Project A and Police Story. Wong was also credited on 36 productions for music, films like Martial Arts of Shaolin, Bullet in the Head, and Once Upon a Time in China. As the entire subplot of Mr. Wong was not in the celestial print, all this footage was not present. And here we have actress Shirley Yu with the white dragon leader Kwok Choi. Despite having been in the industry for a few years now, Kwok maintained self-doubts when cast in Chinatown Kid. He was still learning his craft, and believe it or not, felt that the kissing scenes here with Shirley were extremely difficult. If there was ever a true definition of a shooting star, Shirley would have been the poster child. At just 21 years of age, she lived in a luxurious flat, owned a new Mercedes-Benz, and had a bank full of cash. She had signed a 3-year contract with Shaw in 76, and had become the soft porn queen of the studio. And photos of her were splattered across Southern Screen magazine. Reporters hounded her for interviews. And newspaper ads featured her in provocative poses. She was living the high life. But even before that, her life wasn't too shabby. At 19, she entered the 1974 Miss Hong Kong pageant, which helped catch the eye of several filmmakers. Erotica films were in their heyday, and she had no inhibitions of removing her clothes for the camera. She and her body were seen in such flicks as Crazy Sex and Confessions of a Private Secretary. Shirley was usually cast as a mistress in her movies, and soon life imitated art as she enjoyed an exotic lifestyle, fraternizing with married men who gifted her jewelry and large amounts of cash. When she was added to the cast of Chinatown Kid, reporters were a bit befuddled by Chang's, choice and asked him to explain. And Chang said, there are sex bombs who cannot act, but there are some who can do a great acting job without stripping. Shirley Yu belongs to this latter group. However, like a Roman candle, her career burned out as quickly as it started. The type of erotic films which emphasized mood and plot were on the wane, as the local government loosened the criteria for sex scenes in films and demands for her services were diminishing. She also crashed her Mercedes during the filming of Brave Archer Part 2, and she injured her skull, her neck, and her spine, and by the time she was able to return to work, well, the parade had passed on by. She would take up singing and performed in Southeast Asia as well as the US and Canada, but that would fizzle out in the early 90s. She tried to stage a film comeback in 95, in a movie about Japanese vampires who go on a killing spree in Hong Kong, and then 4 years later invested in a thriller, but both were failing ventures. Later losses in the stock market forced her to become a street hawker, selling costume jewelry, but publicly she wasn't ashamed of how her life turned out. She continued to socialize with her old Shaw pals and did charity work in her spare time. It has been reported that she passed away in 2013. However, I have not found any news articles to cement this finding, just random articles on the internet. As far as Kwok Choi, well, he certainly made a name for himself since starring as the Lizard in The Five Venoms. But before that, he was far from a household name, appearing in minor roles for Chang Che and elsewhere. Alright, so born in Taiwan, his mother was an acrobat, and she couldn't bring all her children on tour with her, so she sent Kwok and his younger brother to Hsinchu, where he got sent to live with his grandmother. The grandmother lived out in the country, and she didn't have much money for, school tuition or other needs for a child. Kwok said that his grandmother was, fairly mean to him and made him do, odd manual labor tasks, so he started skipping school. In the 6 years he stayed with her, he skipped school for 3 of those 6. His mother finally brought him back to Taipei when he was about 13. After living with her for a year, he got his first full exposure to opera when he entered the army-sponsored Lu Kuan Peking Opera School. Now, that name could be a little misleading. Even though it's called a Peking Opera School, students actually learn Taiwanese opera. They sung a Hokkien dialect rather than the Mandarin. There are actually 4 primary opera schools in Taipei, the more famous one being Fuxing, which was an independent school. But the other 3 were run by the military. The Army had Luguang, Air Force was Taipeng, and Navy had Haikuung. Hope I pronounced that right. Anyway, Kwok, he learned tumbling and skills for stage performance for the next several years at the opera. even going to Japan to perform. Later, his girlfriend urged him to seek out a more, you know, traditional, stable occupation, so Kwok became a blacksmith. After only 3 months of heating and hammering, he quit and started to build houses instead, which lasted for another year. At that time, he met Zhang Sheng, in which they started a circus and performed at various clubs in Taipei. But they blew all their money, so they ended up, you know, closing that down after about a half a year. Kwok went over to Japan for another acrobatic performance, and when he returned, Chang Che was shooting an outdoor scene for Boxer Rebellion in Changhua, and he needed some background martial artists. Chang was a famous name in Taiwan, and Kwok had seen most of his films, so while he really wanted the job, you know, he was a little apprehensive. Kwok did get the gig, right, and then was cast again in The Fantastic Magic Baby. When he was told that Chang had interest in using him again for Marco Polo, Kwok thought it was just, you know, further extra work. He'd already promised someone else he was going to go back to Japan to perform, so he initially rejected Chang's offer. Little did he realize that the director wanted him to be one of the four leading men in the movie. And from there, you know, Kwok's film career just shifted into high gear. He appeared in every Venom's movie moving forward, except for two Champions of Shaolin. That's right. He and Liu Fang, they had a falling out at the Rebel Intruder, so he was left out of that movie, and Liu got left out of Ode to Gallantry to kind of balance it out. After Shaw, Kwok went back to Taiwan to make Ninja in the Deadly Trap. There was a very a difficult project for him, he said. He was the director, and he was also acting, and he didn't have, you know, the best experience in making it. He continued to act on various films, such as John Woo's Hardboiled, but also did more and more behind-the-scenes work. He's worked on A Chinese Ghost Story, 1987, Story of Ricky, 92, and The Bride with White Hair in 93. He also did choreography on Police Story 3, but he left the project after falling out with the director. Kwok also had the chance to work on the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Hard Target, but union issues prevented him, so. In any event, his later works included the 97 James Bond movie, Tomorrow Never Dies. He also has a small cameo in that film. And in Europe, he made worked on The Brotherhood of the Wolf, 2001, and Samurai in 2002. And now we're back at that with Jenny Seng's character. Alex and Jenny had met in 73, but didn't start dating until the summer of 74. She was born in Macau, but raised in Hong Kong until her family immigrated to Taiwan when she was 14 years old. Later, while attending the Chinese Cultural University, Jenny was discovered by a casting agent and had her first album released in 1971. After another one later that year, she had three new releases for both 1972 and 1973. And that was just the start, you know. The following year, 1974, she released a total of 10 new albums. So, how did she and Alex meet? Well, was he like a, you know, super fan of hers and lurked in the shadows in hopes of getting an autograph? No. When Alex was in Taiwan for Changgong, he lived with his friends T. Lung and David Zhang. T. Lung was dating actress Amy Dow, and Jenny was friends of Amy while she was in Hong Kong. And that's how it all began. Being the stars they were, or should I say the stars they were becoming, their relationship was heavily scrutinized by the media. As with tabloids, there were various stories published which were either unfair or simply false. It got to the point where Alex composed a letter addressing the misinformation, which was published in one of those magazines in hopes of getting the record straight. Despite living under the microscope, their relationship was strong, and they wed in the first week of December of 76. Alex had planned to go on a trip with Jenny to the United States, but because of his filming schedule, the trip was delayed until after the wedding. But then, about a month later, on January 5th, primary production commenced on Chinatown Kid. And Alex had to go with the director over to the States, you know, to shoot all that extra footage. So he took Jenny along with him for a kind of a pre-honeymoon vacation. Now, all expenses paid, courtesy of the studio. Now we're going to have a little Venom's time here as Lomong and Kwok Choi throw some hands. Well, I've mentioned The Five Venoms a few times as being the film in which several of these actors come together to, you know, officially become known as the Venoms. They had appeared in a series of movies prior, known to some of us as pre-Venom films. So, what exactly are these pre-Venom films and when did they start? Well, for starters, it has to be a Chang Che-directed movie. It has to be made prior to The Five Venoms film and include at least two of the following actors. You have Kwok Choi, who normally plays the hero. Lu Fang, usually the villain and also the consummate weapons expert. You have Zhang Sheng, aka Cutie Pie, a very versatile acrobat tumbler who has a flair for comedy. Lo Mang, who's the muscle man of the group. And Sun Qian, the kicker, sometimes the hero and sometimes the traitor. So let's look at some of these pre-Venom films in release order. I don't have the production dates, just the release order here. Marco Polo, aka the Four Assassins. Then we had New Shaolin Boxers. Shaolin Avengers, Seven Man Army, Magnificent Wanderers. This next one's big. Shaolin Temple, because we have both Kwok Choi, Zhen Sheng, Lu Fang, and first appearance of Lo Mang as the Bald Monk. Then came the Naval Commandos, Brave Archer. I believe Lo Mang is billed here with his real name, not the stage name. Life Gamble, yeah. Released in February of 79, however, started production back in August of 77. Then we have The Chinatown Kid, and that's right, this film, first appearance of Sun Qian. Heaven and Hell. Now, we all know this was released well after the Five Venoms movie. However, this movie actually started production back in March of 75. But then it was, you know, put on ice for a while before resuming in 77, though not released until 1980. After that, we have The Brave Archer, the sequel, and finally, Invincible Shaolin. Now, I know someone's saying right now, whoa, Tico, didn't Invincible Shaolin come out after The Five Venoms? How could it be a pre-Venoms film? Well, yes, it did. 3 months later, actually. But because it included Kar Hui, a few people have wondered if it's possible this picture might have been planned to come out prior to Five Venoms, or at least shot before. And Kara is the clue, as she would go on to join Lager Longsam after this film was made. So, the thinking is, if she was still in Chang's camp, and Invincible Shaolin was made after Five Venoms, why was she not also in the Five Venoms movie? And that's where the lines blur, you know, production versus release dates. I was fortunate to get all the Fu Shang production dates, you know, both start and finish from my book. I wish I'd asked for more of these Venom movies, so, you know, we can be then 100% on these two movies. Unfortunately, we'll still have to continue to wonder what came first, the chicken or the egg. Now, here's an interesting aside to all that. Chang commented in an interview that he wanted to promote the six martial artists when he started The Five Venoms. However, the plan to promote Kwok already started in the previous movie, Life Gamble. The production of Life Gamble finished earlier, but it was held back because Fu Shang also starred in Life Gamble. Chang figured that it would be difficult to promote Kwok with Alex also being in the movie. Therefore, he suggested to the boss to release The Five Venoms to promote Kwok first, and then promote Alex returning to Chang's group for Life Gamble, but no mention here whatsoever of Invincible Shaolin. Alright, what's next? Something Ten Tigers, but that's a stretch. Ten Tigers started originally and back in March of 78. The Five Venoms, no production start date, was released in August of 78. And Chang start the Tigers in March and then crank out and complete Five Venoms and release in under 5 months? Probably not. Let's just call this one an anomaly. It's not parade, it's not even a regular Venoms film, it's just more a compilation piece at best. And this is one of those sequences heavily edited for content in the Celestial version. Our international version here shows more kung fu carnage and is twice as long, actually. With the shorter version, there's a fairly jarring edit as Kwok and Alex kick in the tiger's door, and you know, and boom, Johnny is holding his gun. But in this version, we have ourselves a real brawl between the warring gangs, with some even using dumbbells as weapons before Johnny is looking to unload his weapon. So now, while everyone here is kung fu fighting, let's go back. Way back to the silent era of Hollywood and explore some of the earliest Chinatown films ever made in the West. One of the first, if not the first, Western movie about Chinatown was D.W. Griffith's Broken Blossoms in 1919. It took place in London's Limehouse District. During the early part of the 20th century, Limehouse was a Chinese ghetto with its fog-choked avenues and decaying buildings and weary-looking locals. The hero of this movie was played by an American and not a Chinese. He finds himself the protector of a Caucasian girl whose father is an abusive professional boxer. He is eventually forced to kill the father, and despite saving the girl, she too succumbs to her injuries. And in the end, our hero kills himself. Not exactly a pleasant finale. Griffith shot a second similar film set in London's ghetto, Dream Street, in 1921, but it didn't share the same success as his first effort here. That same year, Emmett Flynn directed Shame, which entailed how the Chinese imported opium into San Francisco and created opium dens within the city. Like Chang Che's Tiger Boy, it is presumed to be a lost film. Well, actually, scratch that. I've heard reports that Tiger Boy is available for viewing at the Hong Kong Film Archives now. That's good news. Anyway, Flynn made another film 4 years later about opium running. However, that was set in the South Pacific and not in Chinatown. Then we had the movie East is West, which was a 1922 silent drama directed by Sidney Franklin, which was about a Chinese millionaire and white slavery. The movie starred Constance Talmadge, who was the youngest of the famous Talmadge sisters, and whose brother-in-law was none other than Buster Keaton, one of my personal favorite directors, as was Jackie Chan's. Now, in 1927, you've got Alan Crosland directing Old San Francisco, which dealt with the illegal immigration of Chinese into the city. The main villain is played by Warner Olin, who later became famous first as Fu Manchu in the 1929 film, the mysterious Dr. Fu Manchu, and later as Charlie Chan, starting with Charlie Chan Carries On in 1931. Olin would star in a total of 16 Chan films before his death in 1938. Now here on the screen, we see Kwok Choi is toying with Lo Mang by firing several intended miss shots, making him dance before he slays him. It's actually a much more heroic death for Lo. In the Celestial version, he just guns him down, that's it. But here, Lo stands like a boss and defiantly walks towards Kwok with no fear. After the brawl, you'll see Fu Sheng, lamenting over killing his Hong Kong nemesis, Johnny. But Kwok, rationalizes the whole situation for him. The two then go upstairs eventually, in which Alex is given Shaw Yin Yim as his victory prize. Looking back at the old Hollywood films, another silent era movie produced in the late 20s was Chinatown Nights, which focused on the gang wars of Chinatown. It's also known as Tong War, and it was set in New York City's Chinatown. And though it began as a silent film, it finishes a talkie with the use of dubbing later on. Coincidentally, as Alex was portraying a gangster for the silver screen, his own parents back home had a run-in with the underworld. Cheng Yan Lung and wife were the unfortunate targets when a brazen trio of armed men and a woman broke into their family home in Kowloon. A man in his mid-20s dressed as a police officer went to the Chung's residence and told their domestic helper he was investigating a traffic accident involving Alex's father. When the worker opened the door, the man rushed in, followed by the three others. The first man was armed with a pistol, while the others threatened the occupants with knives. They tied up Alex's mother, her worker who sustained a knife wound in the struggle, and another man before ransacking the house. A few minutes later, Alex's father came home and was slashed on his right arm before the foursome escaped with about $3,000 in cash and earrings worth $30,000 and took off in Mr. Chung's car. And, this wasn't the first time the well-known businessman and New Territories leader had a brush with the underworld. 3 years prior, he was forced into a taxi by three men who took cash and jewelry from him and then held him for nearly 2 hours hostage before tying him up and fleeing. The actress you see here in the background, that's Yin Yin, known to many in the West as Susan Shaw, no relation to Run Run, who started her career back in the early 70s and is still working today, including three productions that came out this year or 2021. She has had a very up and down life similar to Cara Hui. Born in Hong Kong in 1950, she spent her childhood in Taiwan, and before becoming an actress, she actually worked as a merchant marine nurse in a shipping company. In the early 70s, her ship was berthed in Hong Kong, so she visited an old classmate whose father worked at Golden Harvest. The girls got to hang out with Bruce Lee, who took a shine to Yin, and he suggested that she try out acting. However, one of the management there supposedly made some rather crude comments about her looks, and once Lee passed, well, any chances to work at Golden Harvest were over. But that didn't stop Yin, alright? The seed was planted. A few years later, she worked with In Sin Yoon, who convinced her to strip for the camera. Despite her displeasure for the film and those who worked on it, she eventually embraced the idea of her soft porn erotic roles and became rather infamous for it. Multiple movies later, in the early 80s, Yin was blacklisted for a bit after an incident in Taiwan, and her career took a major downturn. It got so bad she supposedly considered suicide. To make a living, Yin turned to singing on stage, which was a blessing in disguise, actually, as she met a rich Malaysian businessman whom she would marry. A couple kids later, the family settled in San Francisco, but she returned to Hong Kong at some point in the 90s wanting to, you know, restart her career. Now, two stigmas that Yin had to overcome was, one, her past roles as merely a cinema concubine, or as the Associated Press dubbed her, China doll, and two, some botched plastic surgery she had at a very young age. Unfortunately, her husband's infidelities forced her to question her youth and beauty, so she made some bad choices trying to correct her looks. One incident almost cost Yin her life on the operating table. However, like Cara Hui, she did not wallow in past mistakes. Yin pressed forward, began to get better roles, and noticed for her acting chops. In 2008 and again in 2011, she won the Golden Film Awards for Best Supporting Actress. So here we have another omitted scene, the infamous Golden Dragon Restaurant incident. Originally, there was a fictional massacre sequence in the movie, but nothing like the Golden Restaurant event. As Chang was trying to convey the real-world problems of the Chinatowns, Run Run felt this was a significant incident that needed to be addressed. The news of the massacre had shocked many in both Hong Kong and the West, so Chang went back to the studio that September to recreate a new scene for the movie. So, what is this Golden Dragon event, you might be wondering? Well, it's like the director had imagined. When he researched the situation in the Chinatown, he perceived it like a simmering pot that had been covered. Eventually, the contents would boil over. Now, this 1977 incident was motivated by a long-standing feud between two rival gangs, the Zhou Boys and the Hua Qing. Earlier that summer, the two gangs were involved in a shootout in which one of the Zhou Boys lost a member. The Zhou Boys then planned a retaliatory strike at the Golden Dragon Restaurant. The Zhou Boys got a tip that Hua Qing leader Michael Hot Dog Louie, or as Fu Shang might say, Dog Meat Sausage Louie, was dining at the restaurant that evening. The Zhou Boys sprayed the packed eatery with gunfire. They emptied their weapons in under a minute, leaving 5 dead and 11 injured. Ironically, none of whom were gang members. Police called it the worst mass murder in the city's history, in which there was so much bloodshed that one eyewitness compared it to a Vietnamese battlefield. As one of the leading tourist destinations, you know, Chinatown suffered as business and tourist traffic remained depressed for several weeks following the shooting with no arrest. As in most gang wars go, 1 week after Golden Dragon, two Zhou Boys were shot by a Hua Qing gunman, leaving one dead and the other critically wounded. Eventually, 9 gang members were arrested for the September 4 incident, but the 3 gunmen, they were only 17 years of age.
東哥啊, 就得㗎啦, 一陷好張床就得㗎啦。
乜你張床咁貴嘅?
咩貴呀? 我由香港瞓到呢度啊, 都瞓啲咁嘅床㗎啦, 頂天立地啊嘛。 你鍾唔鍾意啊?
Now, over the course of his career, Alex has played in multiple films that you can say are entwined. Of course, the Brave Archer series comes to mind, at least Brave Archer 1 through 3, as Kwok Choi technically takes over in Brave Archer 4, or Brave Archer and His Mate, as it's known to some. And, oh yeah, for those bootleg collectors out there, there isn't a Brave Archer 5 or a Brave Archer 6. All right, Little Dragon Maiden, mislabeled as Part 5, is based on the same novel, Return of the Condor Heroes, as is Brave Archer and His Mate. Part 6? forget about it, okay? That fake Part 6 is actually Chur Yun's Hero Shed No Tears, which does feature Alex, yes, but it's based upon a completely different book. It has nothing to do with Brave Archer. So no 5, no 6. Alright, so another Fu Sheng series. Well, the Shaolin Cycle, of course. Alex played Feng Siyu in Heroes 2, Men from the Monastery, Shaolin Avengers, and Shaolin Temple. Another unofficial trilogy, you might say, are the films Disciples of Shaolin, New Shaolin Boxers, and this movie, Chinatown Kid. In all three of these movies, Alex plays a bit of a country bumpkin who tries to do the right thing, to only find himself further embroiled in a battle much larger than he anticipated. The Disciples and Chinatown especially mirror each other in this. Let's take the white outfit, for instance, okay? In both movies, you know, he's sporting some serious white attire for the finale, which is not the best color if you're trying to conceal a bleeding torso, right? Nevertheless, in both movies, he is taken by surprise by an opponent and decides to conceal his injury to further the fight. In Disciples, it's a little more dramatic as he has his girl, you know, skillfully dress him and, well, dress him for his funeral, as it turns out. But in that movie, his concealed injury plays a major turning point in the battle. In Chinatown Kid, he basically just buttons up, you know, the suit and keeps on rocking. No big thing. Another similar aspect is the watch. In Disciples, our Alex simply only desires a pair of new shoes, right? And when he makes it big, that's the item he is most proud of. In Chinatown, it's the watch. And when he hits the big leagues, what does he do? Well, he's not wearing one, but two digital watches, huh? That's a player. The restaurant manager. All right, Yang Chi Ching and factory owner Lu Ti and Disciples, they have similar qualities and that both are, you know, interested in making that money. But they're not very compassionate about their workers. Of course, Lu Ti, yes, Sun Qin's father in this movie, is a little more sadistic as he basically uses his staff, including his champion fighter Fu Sheng, as mere pawns. And finally, of course, Sun Qian is our Qi Quan Chun in this movie. You know, both characters just want to work hard and do the right thing and not cause any problems. But thanks to that bad seed Alex, you know, they are forced to use their own kung fu against the troublemakers.
大学生，我有什么不对？你连羞耻之心都没有，谁跟你这种人说话？
You see that extra on the far left there? Yeah, that was the same guy that Alex practically ran over with his car. You know, he shouted, "You son of a bitch!" I'm guessing he doesn't hold grudges. I've always wondered what became of these extras. I mean, if they've ever seen these movies or not, or they're just, you know, doing it for a day and that was it. This here is actually one of those rare sequences in which I prefer the celestial version over this one. In that cut, we have Jenny's father, actor Zhang Nam, give our Alex a stern talking to, and he lays a serious guilt trip on him for how he makes a living and how he's destroying Chinese lives. Jenny isn't present in that version, but I really wish they had incorporated that scene in this international print. Now, you may remember Zhang as the king of Eagle Claw in Shaolin Martial Arts, 1974. Other than having about 250 acting roles, he directed 24 movies in the late 50s and early 60s. He would die just 2 years after Fu Sheng in 1985. So, as we see here in these scenes, you know, Alex is helping out his grandfather by sending him a box of glasses, or later trying to assist Sun Qian by giving his boss extra wages for him. One of Alex's closest friends told me that with Alex, what you see is what you get. No matter the role he was playing on the screen, whether he was a bit naughty or stubborn or even childlike, Alex was just being himself. And one of the things about being himself is he was always willing to lend a hand to others in need. Whether he was buying a fellow actor lunch at the Shaw cafeteria or doing favors for others, it became a bit of a double-edged sword for him. In his own words here, I quote, "I am this kind of person. I always feel so friendly to others that sacrificing for them is no big deal. But my wife will warn me, 'Be careful. This person cannot be trusted. Don't you remember the lesson last time?' However, I keep forgetting those lessons and making the same mistake again and again," end quote. And though he seems a little dismissive about the situation, there were other times where he admitted that some took advantage of his generosity and that he wasn't pleased about it. He felt like someone wanted, you know, a piece of him. And yeah, Alex wasn't open to all. He was very distrustful of the media early in his career, but that was due to their, you know, yellow journalism tactics and not because of Alex's personality. Anyway, these character attributes seen here, of him wanting to help others in spite of what might befall him, was truly an extension of the real Alexander. So So, how did Chinatown Kid the movie fare compared to the other films in 1977? Well, it's safe to say that Star Wars' $750 million worldwide receipts are not going to be challenged by this picture. The Shaw Brothers' Deadly Angels, starring Evelyn Kraft, took the top spot for Hong Kong films that year with $7.7 million. There were two other Chinese flicks from Taiwan, actually, that edged out the Deadly Angels in the Hong Kong box office. Those films were Heroes of the Eastern Skies and the classic The Hot, the Cool, and the Vicious. They made $11.5 and $8.2 million, respectively. Now, based on just Hong Kong-produced movies, Chinatown's Kid $1.5 million, and I'm rounding, by the way, grabbed 21st place that year, which was edged out by just a few thousand by another Chang Chae film, The Brave Archer. By the way, those were Chang's top two entries for 77, but his old mentee, La Garlung, fared much better with Executioners from Shaolin, which was number four that year. If we were to add in all the non-Hong Kong-produced movies with Western entries such as The Spy Who Loved Me and Airport 77 and King Kong, well, our Chinatown Kid gets pushed back down to number 36 for the year. And speaking of Star Wars, strangely, of the 20-plus countries that Star Wars released in 1977, Hong Kong wasn't one of them. Even in 78, where Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan got releases, I couldn't find any data for a Hong Kong release. I mean, is that even possible? Anyway, as far as Fu Sheng-only films are concerned, Chinatown Kid was more or less dead center in his repertoire. It was ranked number 18, to be exact, in his resume of 43 completed movies. For Chang Che-directed films, you know, featuring Fu Sheng, Chinatown Kid was number 5. Now, Alex's biggest grossing movie of all time? Well, that would be Legendary Weapons of China, which brought in $9.9 million in 1982. And while that seems like a big deal, it was still ranked number 9 for that year. And that's the problem with comparing such numbers. It's not like we're working in a vacuum here where all things are equal. Ticket prices vary from year to year. Number of days released, number of screens, there's lots of variations, you know? So, plus there's always, you know, diverse competing films. To make such a comparison is like asking which actor was better, Jackie Chan or Fu Sheng. Okay, my money's on Alex, by the way. I don't have actual production costs to determine if this film was deemed profitable by the bean counters back in Movie Town, but we can be rest assured it was the movie that provided Alex with international recognition, and that in itself is the true value of this production. Before we get too close to our end, let's do a short recap of Alex's career and those final days of his life. Outside of his early cameo roles, he worked with Chang Che on 25 straight productions before joining Ti Lung and director Sun Chung on Avenging Eagle and then The Deadly Breaking Sword. Both these productions are top shelf and must see. Alex then worked on three projects for Chor Yun between 78 and 79, four if you're counting Mark of the Eagle. He then teamed up with the Lau brothers, Treasure Hunters and Fake Ghost Catchers with La Gar Wing, and a trio with his Kung Fu Master, those three being Legendary Weapons of China, Eight Diagram Pole Fighter, and Cat vs. Rat. His final films were with actor-director Wan Jing. They were Hong Kong Playboys and Wits of the Brats. Now, many know that this latter film was the directorial debut for Alex. He had other projects previously in mind to direct, but they never came to be. As far as his personal life, he and Jenny seemed to have a fairy tale marriage initially. But as the years passed, the facade faded and marital problems came to light. Of course, you know, it's easy, or lazy, you might say, to point fingers and blame their breakup on, you know, Jenny's domineering ways or Alex and his wrongdoings or simply on the disadvantage of being a celebrity couple. You know, despite their best efforts to keep themselves grounded, it was never enough. With their marriage on the rocks, they split in the spring of 83 and were heading for a divorce. Of course, this never came to pass due to the unfortunate events soon to come. That first week of July, Jenny had traveled to Japan with her sister, and Alex was living with his older brother. He and three others visited the Clearwater Country Bay Club on the evening of July 6th, and upon leaving, Alex's Porsche lost control and wrecked. 5 hours later, Fu Sheng was pronounced dead. The industry, his fans, and family, they were stunned beyond words. All production at Movie Town stopped as the Shaw staff worked on the funeral arrangements for their much-beloved leading man. A lot of uncertainty surrounded this catastrophic event for many years. When we were in Hong Kong, we visited the Central Library to find answers and printed out several microfilm articles of the South China Morning Press. We confirmed that Alex was indeed not driving. He had appeared in court that fateful morning and lost his license for a month. That evening, his older sibling took the wheel of the two-seater sports car, whereas the others, brother and actor David Chung and actor Wang Yu, drove in a second vehicle. Only minutes from the club, the accident occurred across from the bus station at the Clearwater Bay Second Beach, in which no other vehicles were involved. I put the exact GPS coordinates in my book in case anyone wishes to stop by and pay respects. Of course, if you want to visit his burial site in the New Territories, it's at the Feng Yin Sin Kung Temple, very easy to visit via the MTR. Just visit the main office and they'll direct you to the precise location. So back to the action here. You know, I've always wondered who at the Shaw Brothers department got the task of outfitting these cars with those super wide California plates. You see them there? Yeah, obviously they've never seen an actual tag, which is, you know, much smaller, or they were just trying to cover up the Hong Kong plate already on the vehicle. But, you know, hey, we got to give them props. Oh, there's a pun. For trying to make us believe they were actually in the States. I guess it would have been pretty difficult to move the steering wheel over to the correct side and still drive it. But I digress. So who's this guy with Alex? Well, that's Lam Fai Wong. He's a Shaw regular throughout the 70s and the 80s, starting back with Chang Che's The Angry Guest in 1972. Along with Chi Kwun Chun, he was in the first class of Chang's film company's training course. And so what's your thoughts here on Alex looking like Miami Vice, huh? I mean, sporting the white suit? With all, you know, all due respects to Al Pacino, who made the look fashionable in Scarface, Alex was indeed the trendsetter by donning these threads nearly 6 years before the Brian De Palma film. And now here we're back at the White Dragon Casino Club, and things aren't going as planned. Kwok has no choice but to do it the old-fashioned way now. So he's going to break out the old armory here and head on over to the restaurant and find out where that Alex might be. Of course, by them leaving, it makes things a little easier for Alex when he pays a visit to the casino in a bit. And Shirley Yu, looking very denim chic here with her late 70s style. Hopefully the props department didn't give these guys real guns. This is a nice little intercutting going on here between the stateside, you know, B-roll footage is the Golden Gate Bridge, and then the action in Hong Kong. You know, where are we? We in U.S.? We in Hong Kong? I mean, it's very seamless. You know, you can't tell. I mean, well, I could tell. Yeah, they're driving the wrong side of the road. Okay, never mind. All right. Fu Sheng always said that he had two buddies in the film circle. One was T. Lung, of course, and the other was this guy here, Lam Fai Wong. Fu Sheng took good care of Lam, you know, fighting for his benefits, venting out injustices against him, and Alex didn't mind falling out with others on account of him. And Lam was one of Alex's pallbearers at his 1983 funeral, and in his career, worked on 26 films with Alex, the most by any actor. And yeah, I know that because I actually made a spreadsheet while researching my book. I probably could have written a second book titled Everything You Wanted to Know About Fu Sheng, but was afraid to ask. And now Fu Sheng is going to take care of some serious business by attacking the White Dragon Club. Another close friend of his was this guy here wielding the shotgun. That is Jamie Luke Kim Ming, who was one of Alex's best men at his wedding. He's originally from Jingsu, who joined Chang's company in 73 as a basic actor. He gradually developed a strong interest in film production and began to work behind the scenes. His first produced screenplay of 16 scripts was The Legend of the Owl in 1981, which he co-wrote with Derek Yee and was directed by David Zhang. Starting in 85, he would begin directing and shot 24 pictures while he continued to act. Jamie has appeared in a total of over 160 movies, as well as wore, you know, various other hats behind the scenes. I believe he is still active in the industry and pops up on social media from time to time. Alex here battling out with Wong Lee, and there goes the staircase. You may have seen the staircase elsewhere. It was featured in Chang's Naval Commandos, which wrapped production in March 77 and was released the following month. I'm sure I've seen it in at least one or two other movies. You know, the Shaws, they had a tendency to recycle sets and costumes, etc. Possibly the most prolific was the Shaw carpet. This is a yellow rug adorned with blue patterns that seemed to pop up in countless martial arts films. Matter of fact, it appeared so many times, I think it even had its own entry in either Hong Kong Movie Database or the Hong Kong Cinemagic Database. Hands down, Choi Wong got a serious butt-whipping in his final scene, and you know, no amount of Tylenol is going to fix that headache. And as you see here, this is why Wong Lee is not someone you ever turn your back on. Alex, what are you thinking? The bloody torso, which will eventually do in Alex's character. At some point in the Celestial print, they'll go to another cut for the ending, and you know, like magic, the suit will no longer be covered in blood. No doubt Jenny had some of that Calgon back at the Mon Lee laundry shop. But here, Alex just has to button up and, you know, keep on trucking, like I said. And here's our next to last sequence of the movie at the restaurant, soon getting strung on by Kwok Choi and company. Soon would only make a few more films with Alex after this. It was Brave Archer 2 and 3, but he was absent from the fourth installment. Also the On, Off, and On Again, Ten Tigers of Kwan Tong, and Heaven and Hell. They did seem to work well here together. It's unfortunate we didn't get to see them in another project down the road when, you know, Soon's acting chops had matured further. When Fu Sheng passed in the summer of 83, I had just graduated high school and, you know, was killing time pumping gas. Yeah, we do that in Jersey, pump gas. Before entering into the U.S. Air Force. We had left New York City 4 years prior, where I was born and raised, but I continued to visit the city as a teen. At the time, that summer, I was unaware of Fu Sheng's passing. Matter of fact, I don't believe I heard anything until around 2000. At some point in the 80s, I left the genre and, you know, got busy with other things, military and college, marriage. When I got back into the scene 20 years ago, that's when I found out about the accident. Anyway, yeah, I do have a point here. All right, bear with me. Back in 83, that fall, the Music Palace held a Fu Sheng retrospective. Music Palace? You've heard the name? Maybe, maybe not. Well, the Palace was the last Chinese language movie theater to close in New York City's Chinatown. It was the last of the grindhouse theaters of New York, possibly the East Coast. Nonetheless, the building was constructed in the late 1890s and opened as the Universal Photoplay in 1914. Eventually, it took on the name of the Music Palace, but the vertical Chinese characters, you know, to the left of the marquee translated as the Chun Kung Theater. I actually like the sound of that much better. The Palace was one of many theaters in Chinatown that were quite popular with the locals. Starting in the mid-60s, first-run kung fu films like the classic Come Drink With Me were on display. Gorgeous widescreen prints with both English and Chinese subtitles. While the Palace specialized in Golden Harvest releases, plenty of Shaw flicks were on display. The theater was actually managed by Golden Films International, which was a subsidiary of the Shaw Brothers, and in the later 70s and 80s, the Palace was the spot to see kung fu flicks. Unfortunately, you know, change was coming, and the Chinatown theaters began to drop like flies. The Pagoda was demolished in 92, the Sun Sing, 93, the Rosemary in 96. Eventually, the Palace would also come to an end. Why? Well, that's a whole nother commentary. But back to Fu Sheng. Okay, so September 17, 1983, the Palace's retrospective to Fu Sheng commenced with the double feature Disciples of Shaolin and Chinatown Kid. On the 20th, Heroes 2 and Men from the Monasteries. And finally, on the 23rd, Deadly Breaking Sword and New Shaolin Boxer. Six Fu Sheng flicks in 1 week. I mean, wow. Had I known about this event, I would have driven up to the city in a heartbeat. I can't even begin to fathom what it would have been like sitting in a packed, emotionally charged auditorium of fellow Shaw fans, you know, celebrating and mourning the life and times of Alexander Fu Sheng. In my mind, outside of being in Hong Kong and attending his funeral, this would have been the ultimate expression of reverence and reflection of an actor who ignited the screen. No, he was not Bruce Lee. No, he was not Jackie Chan. He was Alexander Cheng Fu Sheng, a son, a brother, a husband, a friend, a screen icon who captured the hearts and minds of a million viewers as they silently sat in the dark and vicariously lived through their hero's exploits on the flickering screen in front of them. He may have only lived 28 years of age, but as I mentioned in my book, the key to immortality is first living a life worth remembering. Indeed, Fu Sheng will truly live on through the minds of his family, friends, and yes, his fans. All right, as we are quickly approaching the end here, I need to do some parting comments. It has been truly a unique experience speaking with you all. A big shout out to Arrow Video for not only putting out an exceptional box set of Shaw Classics, but for providing us fans with the international print of The Chinatown Kid. This is how many of us remember this movie, and it's great to see it get a proper release. I also want to thank all of you who may have purchased my book, Alexander Fu Sheng, Biography of the Chinatown Kid. It has received an incredible amount of positive feedback, and I'm happy that I can contribute something to this fantastic genre of film. Finally, I want to thank you, yes you, for listening, for watching. No matter where we live on this little planet of ours, we are all one big family when it comes to the Shaw Brothers universe. Whether this is your first viewing or your 100th, I hope you continue to support the Shaw Library. Personally, I own about 300 of these movies. However, their library is even more vast, chock full of varying genres, featuring a wide assortment of talent. Be sure to check out more of Arrow's releases and enjoy. And on that note, I'm out. This is Tico, signing off.
我这，难道？